Catch up with the entire season of Pandora anytime on the CW app or download it on iTunes. You can also watch Pandora in Canada on the Space Channel.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, and welcome to another episode of Unboxing Pandora. This time, we're looking at the first episode, Shelter from the Storm, the original premiere, which premiered on the CW on July 15th, 1926, which premiered in July 2019 on the CW and around the world, including Space Channel in Canada. And I'm thrilled to be here with our fantastic composer, one half of our amazing composer team, who actually who scored the entire pilot, Joe Kramer. And I'm also here with producer and post-production supervisor, Aaron Ratner.
Morning, everyone. Hello.
So this is going to be an episode where we go through PTSD, trying to remember what it was like delivering this. There's a reason we're recording this commentary last, because this was brutal, and I don't think any of us have looked back at it since it aired, just because, you know, we've talked about this before. The show got picked up by the network in February. It had to be on the air in July. It was a lot of visual effects. We had a very short window. We didn't start shooting until the end of April. Into May on this episode, and it was on the air in July. So no one had any time, and it's a miracle that this thing actually aired and is as good as it is. So now join us as we open the box on Pandora and look at episode 101, Shelter from the Storm. Start your VCRs. What? Your VCRs. Get your DVRs, your computers, your Blu-rays, whatever you're watching it
on. Your Viewmaster.
Ready? Your Viewmaster. Because here we go. Beep. Okay, so this is through the magic of drones and through the magic of audio. This is Mark A. Altman, in case you didn't remember from the introduction, showrunner and creator of Pandora. And this was actually in the hills. This is on a backlot, Boyana. I guess it was used for a criminal procedural that was built show in Sofia. The interesting thing was I was seriously thinking of shooting this in L.A., in Malibu, and having a second unit shoot it, because I thought there was no way we would find, like, sort of a cool, modern, contemporary-looking house. We cut a ton of shots out of that, but you actually saw her parents going about their business. And I think there was miscommunication with the director, because I said, you know, I don't want to see them too clearly, because, you know, eventually, you know, I'd like to bring the mom back at the end of the season, and it's not going to be the extra we cast here. You know, we're going to cast somebody. And then the way he shot it, you just, like, were always on the back of their heads, and it didn't work. So we cut that out. Now, here we are. This is Crafty Abe's first effect work of the episode. And not my favorite shot, but it was used in every promo for the show. So, but that's okay. I love this. Now, listen to this great score by Joe.
Oh.
And the soundtrack album is coming out in January. Or if you're listening to this after January, it's already come out, and you must get it from La La Land. What a beautiful job that Joe and Panka have done throughout the series. But I think this pilot is particularly really great. I've worked with Joe for a long time. Oh, we're not even looking at the right version of this. But that's okay.
Is the timing right?
As long as the timing's right,
yeah,
I think
everything is right.
Okay. I love this shot. This to me was my homage to Star Trek The Motion Picture, where Kirk arrives at Starfleet Command. And, you know, and Crafty Ape just nailed it. I love this, you know. Tian in Chinese means higher altitude. We, in the writer's room, we spent a day naming the airline. We had all these different options for the, you know, and it had to be something that would clear too. And this was an image I had very early on, the whole idea of the submerged Eiffel Tower. And in fact, our science advisor said, you know, the water would never be that high due to climate change. And I'm like, I don't care. So I got off on the right foot with the science advisor there. And I love the shot. So, yeah, so Joe, I mean, we've been doing this. I'm sorry. Let me just say one thing about this shot.
Yeah, yeah.
This is actually a really super modern building in Sofia. And I found out one of the little girls, it was her birthday. So halfway through shooting, I stopped and made them bring out a cake and sing happy birthday to this extra.
Aww.
It was like the greatest day of her life, I think. It was the first time I saw somebody smile. but it was I love the way this looks. When we were scouting, I mean, a couple months earlier when we were scouting Sofia, I said, oh, my God, this is great. We have to use this. And, you know, I kind of figured this would be the spaceport. And it's funny because that really great shot from beneath the escalator, I remember when we were on the scout, everybody said, where are you going? I was going to, they said, there's just a parking garage down there. I said, yeah, but when I scout, I like to see everything because you never know what you're going to find. And we go down and there's like this great, like, you know, shot. And, you know, I'm like, hey, Steve, come, who's the director, come down here and look. And he's like, this is awesome. I want to shoot this. I'm like, well, I know, right? And he's like, yeah. And we're both like, this is great. And everybody's like, well, why are you down there in the parking garage? So anyway.
There's a great awesome. Angle on that shot.
I love that. It's just super futuristic and cool looking and everything. And so anyway, but so Joe, God, yeah. We've known each other forever, haven't we?
Yeah, 20 years now almost.
We met at a book signing. Now I must say we were both on the panel. We weren't like going to get somebody.
Actually, I wasn't on the panel. My ex-wife was on the panel.
I know. Yeah. I wasn't sure you wanted to say that.
I don't mind.
Yeah, his ex-wife's on the panel, and it was really funny because. Finished the panel, and she introduced me. She says, my husband, Joe. He's a composer. Maybe one day you'll use him. And I said,
oh,
Joe.
Great, another composer.
I said, no, but you know what I said. I said, you're not Joe Kramer by any chance. And he goes, as a matter of fact, I said, I am listening to Way of the Gun, like, constantly, all the time. When I write, that's all I've been listening to lately. I was writing this film noir thing, and I just love, even though it's a Western, it had a very noir kind of thing to it.
It was a great movie.
And I was just like, oh, my God, I love that. It's great, and we are totally going to work together one day. And
here we are.
And here we are.
to Joe's regret still.
Not at all, man. Listen, man, loyalty, high priority in my life, you know.
I love working with Joe. We've had a lot of great projects we've done together, and this is my favorite. I mean, because Joe and I are both huge, as are you, huge sci-fi fans, and space in particular.
Spaceships.
So I remember when I called Joe and I
lasers.
Said, I got good news. I said, I got a TV show going at the CW. He says, oh, great. I said, and it's space.
I know.
It's sci-fi. Are you in?
I was in.
Where do I sign up?
And so I had a backlog of material that I'd created, both in terms of just my own personal study and demos for projects that fell through. And it came in really handy with the schedule on this show that, you know, I would do stuff for you, and then if it needed revision, I could pull from that backlog of material to give you other options and other alternatives for cues. So what I love about this show is even though we had a short schedule, the final result is actually the product of years of writing for me.
Mm.
You know,
we learned so much on this, and as Joe said, there was just so little time. And, I mean, this is the longest we had on any of the shows. We had 8 days to shoot the quote-unquote pilot. It wasn't a pilot because, basically, we sold the show without a pilot. We went straight to series. But, you know, we had 8 days. But the crew was learning to work together. We learned the strengths, the weaknesses. And, you know, Aaron was setting up the whole pipeline for post, you know, editorial and then how the, you know, effects work. And, you know, I have to say, the effects and all that went pretty smoothly, all things considered, in terms of the pipeline, you know, technically.
Yeah, I mean, we did have some time in the beginning to work out a lot of the technical issues and do tests and things like that while you guys were doing photography in Bulgaria. But Chris and his team, you know, he's a pro, Chris Ledoux over at Crafty Apes, you know, coordinating with all the different groups that were bringing this all together on our tight schedule. They were really, you know, they have a lot of experience and they're really skilled at
Can't say enough good things about Chris Ledoux and his team at Crafty. They just really came through and, you know, they only wanted to do the best job. I mean, we were getting shots, you know, which we would say are final, and they were never final because Chris would keep working on them until the very last second, and sometimes beyond the very last second. But, you know, that's a testament to their passion and their quality and their love for the show. I love everyone in this shot. There's Vikash Bahai, who plays the character of Professor Martin Schrall. This was very much inspired, the scene by The Paper Chase with John Houseman, which was a big inspiration for the show in general, the Paper Chase movie and its subsequent TV series. I love what Martin said. He said, you know, I'm so used to being cast as terrorist number six and all that. He said, to come and play a teacher who is an inspiration to these kids and, you know, play a real nuanced role. He was so moved and touched. And we all felt really that really meant a lot to us. I mean, it was the same thing, you know, for John Kim, and he talked about this a little bit. You know, the Asian role is often the asexual, neutered kind of role in these things. And for us, he was the love interest, and he got to kiss the girl and romance the girl. And, you know, we never thought twice about it. But, you know, for him, he's like, that's like a really unique, great thing. And, you know, I'm glad because, you know, the diversity of the show, none of it's forced. It's all just because we genuinely believe in it, not because anyone's saying, oh, you know, you have to have this or that. And, you know, I always wanted a female lead for the show. And you know, obviously Priscilla embodies that so well. She's mm-hmm. done a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. And she's such a pleasure, you know, to work with and, you know, have on board. And this, of course, is the Military Academy and where we shot in Sofia, which is...
you can tell it's military by Atria's costume.
You know, one of the mistakes I made was not... I have a thing about super titles. I like to avoid using super titles, but I really wish that I had, you know, super titled like the year and like Geneva, because people... Even my wife didn't know we were that the school's supposed to be in Geneva, Switzerland. And... I don't know how important it is to the story, but I probably could have led people, given them a little more information about where they are and stuff. I think maybe next season we'll do a little more super titles. I mean, if it's good enough for Star Wars.
Yeah, really. You just put a line of dialogue in, you know?
Yeah.
One thing.
This is a very long scene, by the way. So between the music and the dialogue, it's like everybody. I got a lot of people were saying, "Oh my God, you got this scene where just a bunch of people talking for like 12 minutes, you know, in the bar." But
I think it does a nice job of doing. You know, you got to introduce the characters and you know, we kind of, you know, get straight into the action. So we got to. You know, this is a good scene where it plays out. Little nuances and introduces all the individuals. You know, it's going to be our group that we're going to see for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I was the responsible for creating all of the score for the episode one. But in discussion with Mark about the show, the schedule of the show conflicted with some obligations I already had in place. Mm-hmm. And so we decided we were going to bring somebody on. And rather than do the whole sort of ghostwriting secret partner thing.
Like most composers
which
do.
Kind of drives me nuts.
On television.
Yeah. I thought, well, I'll do it if we can make her a proper collaborator. And we have a mutual friend, and his wife is a brilliant composer, Penka. And so we brought her on board, and it was a happy coincidence that she was from Bulgaria, where you were shooting the show.
Total coincidence. You know, it wasn't we didn't hire her because we got a tax credit, because there are no tax credits there.
Right.
We didn't hire her because, you know, we hired her just because... Big fan. She wrote an original symphony called the Female Astronaut.
Yeah, the Woman Astronaut. Yeah.
Which is wonderful. She's done a lot of video game scores and some smaller, low-budget movies. But really talented. And I remember we were sitting at Casa Vega, and we were talking about it. And we said, you know, we both were fans of Penka and instantly came to the agreement. It was like, let's bring her in to, you know, help you do episodes 2 through 12.
Right. And so, like, my process generally, I like to work against the film. You know, the script and you sent me the Bible, and I had the script. But the film, to me, is what I'm scoring. And so much can change in the way you shoot it, the way you block it, the way you cut it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was funny because I would wait for the footage and then score that. Penka had read the script and looked at the Bible and sent me a bunch of sketches of different themes for different characters that she had considered before, you know, you'd even shot the show.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's
it was a great mix of styles. And so even though I wrote the score for the pilot... There's a few pieces in the pilot that actually came from Penka's pre-production work that she had done and, of course, made sure she got proper credit for that.
Well, she's so thoughtful, you know. She's just a very thoughtful composer and, you know, was a big booster for the show and really just delivered some beautiful music. I'm so mm-hmm. glad. It was such a great collaboration between you guys.
I know. It was really great.
And I love all this. You know, this to me is sort of leaning into the Star Trek of it all, mm-hmm. sort of the anti, especially now it's so important, the anti, you know, xenophobia, anti-racism, you know, and this is that classic metaphor allegory, you know, the alien is the outsider, you know, and, you know, I just, and Ben was just such a find. I mean, it's hard to find Leonard Nimoy, you know, it's hard to find that guy he's particularly, you know, we wanted a guy who could not only be a great actor, but who was empathetic, who could straddle the line between being hero and villain, and also look hot in the makeup, you know, and look good in the makeup, and be a potential love interest for Jax. And he just does it all. And then he was the gift that kept on giving because we found out he was a martial artist and did parkour and did gymnastics. So it was just, like, fantastic. And he has such an enthusiasm and he just fell in love with the role, and we all just fell in love with Ben. He's soft-spoken early in his career. But, you know, again, it was a series of happy accidents on the show because we didn't have much time to cast. I mean, John we wanted because we'd worked with him on Librarians and loved John and know, you know, he's a great actor. He's a great guy. You know, we were so thrilled to have him say yes, you know, but so many other things. It's like, you know, the lead of your show, who hopefully is going to be working with for, you know, 5, 7, 10 years, you know, and you want to make sure, you know, everybody gets along and they're happy to be there and they're a long way from home. And, of course, Priscilla, you know, just really was all that and more. And then, you know, Oliver Dench is just unbelievable, such so thoughtful, smart, charismatic. Really, we're very, very lucky, you know, all the way to, you know, all the supporting roles and the teachers and, you know, I remember Noah Huntley, who plays Osborne, had really, you know, marked up the script and done a lot of homework. And we were so crazy in prep, me and Steve Hughes, the director, that we hadn't really had much of a chance to talk to him other than welcome him aboard. He really just wanted to talk about it. So he was coming to town. He's like, can we get on the phone? And we said, okay, yeah, we'll get on the phone with you. And we were actually at the spaceport. We're on the phone with him for like an hour talking about his role. It's like finally we're like, we have to go to set and film. But that's how seriously he takes it. That's wonderful.
I was so grateful that Steve and you hit it off and that he was able to do this pilot.
Well, yeah, Steve was actually introduced to us by Joe. Joe had told us he had worked with Steve and knew Steve. Steve, of course, had done episodes of Killing Eve, and he'd done Doctor Who. And we had
done a show called Creeped Out together.
Right, you'd done Creeped Out. And so we really liked his reel. You know, we talked to him on the phone because he was in England. Really liked Steve. And, you know, Steve had the unenviable task of sending this ship out to sea because, you know, sort of inventing the way things are done. And, you know, did a really great job. He did the first two episodes you know, it was really when everybody was still figuring things out, you know, how to work together, you know, how to light certain sets. And it was a real challenge. And he did a great job sort of marching the army into battle. Now, this was a curveball we got the last second. You know, Benita, who plays Pilar, was supposed to start. And we get a call that, oh, her movie in India is running late. Can we let her finish? It's going to be an extra week and a half.
Wow.
So we had to juggle the schedule. And we ended up rewriting the script, which ended up being a blessing because we took out a lot of Pilar scenes and added a lot of John Kim. So originally she went to the planet and not John Kim. Greg, and he, like, it was great because I got to write all this new stuff for Greg. Because when I read in the script, I didn't know it was going to be John Kim as Greg. So it was like, I always felt like he was sort of underserved in the pilot. And so it was so great to be able to go back and write all this new stuff for Greg. And then, you know, Pilar became a lot smaller part of the first episode. And we don't really spend more time with her till episode two.
So was there a subtext with Pilar and Raylan in terms of both vying for Jax's attention on the planet? Because that was a nice subtext.
No,
she had
that was
on
all
the
new
planet.
Stuff. There was none of that. She was just, I think she stayed at the ship.
I like actually. The metronome out there on the set. That's a cool touch.
Oh. Well, this was, you know, again, it was so thinly set deck at this point. Nobody, you know. I've said told the story before, but Steve Hughes, me and Max Schmiggy, our wonderful, amazing DP, went to IKEA and a couple others and bought a bunch of stuff and decorated the set ourselves because there was just nothing there, and we felt it looked like a bunch of plywood.
Right.
And
but that works. You know?
Oh yeah,
that's where sci-fi tchotchkes come from.
And I kept saying that. Sight. I said original Star Trek. You know, Salt Shaker as the hypo. You know, it's like
Liam Neeson's communicator in Phantom Menace is a lady razor.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it was important to me that her side of the room be really messy because I'm like, why are these? Everything's always pristine in sci-fi. Well, you know, I don't think she's not a teenage girl, but I don't think college dorm person is going to change that much. That their clothes aren't going to be all over the floor and the suitcases open and everything put away and the sheets. You know, they get up and make their beds every day. I don't think so. So it's like
one thing I really like about the production design of the show is, unlike a lot of sci-fi, it doesn't feel compelled to make everything future.
But I think that's real. I think that's the world.
Yeah,
that's
the real 2019, world. 2020, you go to Europe, things still look like they did in the 1800s. You know what I mean? It's sort of this funny thought that nothing will look like today 100, 200 years from now. And I agree with you. I don't think that's what would really
And I felt, you know, that was something that was really important to me. So I have this mix of the old and the new. And it wasn't just a production consideration. It was also like an aesthetic. It was very important to me aesthetically. This scene, by the way, is based on something that really happened to me. I was bitching about in college about my Latin teacher and how some test was really unfair and what a bitch she was. And she was standing right behind me, and she called me out on it. And it was really embarrassing, and I was mortified for days. But eventually I ended up becoming pretty friendly with her, and it was all water on the bridge. She's lovely, and it was just my whole issues about – you know, not I hated foreign language requirement. I just didn't have a facility for foreign languages. Now I wish I took Bulgarian in college.
But can you speak Klingon?
No, God, no. I wish I'd learned French, though. But Latin turned out not to be very useful. But go figure. But yeah, so that scene is actually based on something that really happened to me. And it's just as mortifying now to watch it as when I experienced it X amount of years ago.
One thing I really like about this show and working with you is that you embraced the use of themes, and in composing today in film and television, so much of it, themes are, you know, poo-pooed by the directors or the creatives. They don't want themes. They want sort of texture and ambience.
And see, I love themes.
It was great to be able to come up with a theme, a musical identity for each character and culture in the show. And then be able to use those.
Because, I mean, I was at the dentist the other day, and they played, like, you know, classical music channel, and all of a sudden Yoda's theme came on. I'm like, oh, that's Yoda's theme. And I was like, and then the guy comes on, this is classical 97, and that was Yoda's theme by John Williams.
Wow.
I'm like, yes, but what orchestra was it? Because it was definitely not the London Symphony.
And the LSO.
There was a big cut that was the last thing we cut from this episode. There was this whole thing where Alison Pevney, who's based on Harlan Ellison and Joseph Pevney, talks mm-hmm. about Groucho Marx and this joke about books. And I hated – it was the last thing to cut. I kept telling the editor, he said, we can cut this out. I'm like, to get to time. I'm like, no, that's going to be the last thing we do. I really don't want to do that. And eventually, we had to cut it to get to time. And it just killed me because it was just – he delivered it perfectly, and it was really good. And, yeah, and Tommy's great. Tommy's getting a lot of attention now for the Kojima game, Death Stranding. And,
wow.
You know, he has this great baritone voice. Mm-hmm. You know, I keep joking we're going to do the musical episode next season, but I haven't told Joe that yet, so.
Oh, okay.
I think that's a third season episode. Yeah. I don't see that
we'll
as.
See. Yeah. It's funny. Vikash, is it a Doctor Who thing? That's because I do a lot of work with Doctor Who people, too, and I saw him come up in that, and I was like, it's so great
cool.
to see everybody
a lot of Doctor
you know,
Who
working
veterans.
In the genre and.
Well, we do that throughout the season, you know, especially once we found our sea legs. It's like casting Aaron Gray and mm-hmm. Charisma Carpenter and Miriam Diabo and Manu Bennett. It was like great casting all like our genre faves.
Yep.
She's great, Tamina Sunny.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a little sneak preview for season two. It's going to play a big part of season two. Don't tell anyone.
All right.
Yeah, really, really. We love Regan.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, the whole Freed, you know, family thing has really paid off and developed really nicely.
And wait until you see what happens with Osborne. Ooh. Catch you next season.
So this is why I don't read the scripts, so I get surprised when I get the episodes. When I did 11, and we opened the coffin at the, you know, the Pandora's right. box at the end of the episode, I couldn't wait to see 12 because I didn't read the episodes ahead of time. Yeah. So I was like the audience only. I guess I was about 2 weeks ahead of the audience with the schedule.
I think we were about 2 weeks ahead of the audience writing.
Yeah, right.
It was. I mean, this is not the way to do a show. It was so tight. I mean, it was so. It's amazing the show turned out as well. Now, this is the whole idea. They're in the holodeck, basically, VR simulator. It just seemed to us as though this was fun. This was a fun night for Steve, the director. It was a fun night for me. Unfortunately, we had just shot at another location, and we had to do a company move from the spaceport downtown out to the back lot, and we didn't have as much time as we would have liked, because we would have liked to have made more of a meal of this, but it was still super fun. Everyone was in, you know, World War II costumes, and at one point we were, like, tied up trying to get an authentic German grenade. They're like, no, you don't pull the pin on it. It's this long tube. We got to get an authentic thing, and it's like, no one's ever going to see it. Who cares? You know, and then we have the and we talked about this for a long time, the transitions to the VR classrooms. Now, that's not actually one of our transitions, because it's like she's having this PTSD, but, eventually, I don't think we ever really quite landed on what the transition was going to be, because it changed.
There's a touch of it with the horse.
Yeah. That one really worked.
And then we started to like this classroom better. I always hated the set. And but by the end of the show, it started looking better. You know, we kept making it darker and darker until you couldn't see anything. It was like, okay, now I like it.
there's a cloud of fog at one point, I think.
So Raylan's theme, which develops throughout the show, actually came from, I think, something Penka had originally sketched out for the Protectors.
Oh, nice.
But I had an instinct that, as the sort of mysterious element in the show, I wanted the Protectors to be the only thing that had any kind of human voice to it.
Right, the choral.
And choral, yeah. Or singing. Choir and voice are used a lot more in film music now than they were in the time of Star Trek or the original Star Wars movies. And I just wanted to save it just for the Protectors. Mm. So other material that we had created, Pink and I, to develop the show, we would pull from. And the theme she had originally written for the Protectors had a really cool quality that shifted between major and minor that I thought would be really strong for Raylan, because we don't know where his alliances
lie. Yeah, no, and it really works. I like Raylan's theme a lot. Yeah.
And the other thing we tried to do was avoid too much tie to Earth cultures for aliens. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, you know, Galactica did a lot with a sort of Middle Eastern sound for the Cylons.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't want to get too Middle East. There's touches of it, but I tried never to be like, oh, that's definitively Persian or Greek or whatever. I didn't want to get too Galactica with Raylan.
Yeah, I mean, I love Bear's score for Galactica, but said that, I totally agreed. I'm like, no, we have to have a different approach. Also because it's been done.
We didn't start using the choral stuff. When was the first episode we used?
No, we used the choral right in this one. When they go into the gateway, into the portal.
Yep. And I hint at it when they're walking through the cave, because I know they're going to be approaching the portal. And then we didn't really use it for quite a few episodes. And then we came back to it maybe around 9.
Right.
With Wilson, the clothing model.
Yeah. This is so funny because it's like, I remember, you know, we're just filming like on this cement outside the school, like, you know, like a driveway, and it was just nothing cool about it. And then, you know, when they put the effects in, it's like, oh, finally, when I looked at it, you know, finally, and I was like, oh, now it really works. Like, even this, we couldn't find a control room that was good. Everything was like a Soviet bunker, like, you know, and it was like, we couldn't, and it was all run down, and we wanted something super modern. So literally, all we were shooting basically was a desk here. This had a curve at the spaceport. It was like, if you turn the camera around the spaceport, there would be like the security desk. Everything else was put in digitally, and you know, it looks cool because it's different than, you know, we just couldn't find a control room that worked. I mean, it was all like looked like a factory or something.
And Chris hated us for this, our VFX, for doing that. That wasn't part of the original plan.
Well, yes and no, because it was part of the plan, because he was aware of that. But what he wasn't aware of was the green screen, because the way that this was being shot, there was all this stuff in the background that he would have had to paint out.
Right.
So we made a decision that night. It's like, let's put in green screen because he's got to paint this out. It's going to be harder to roto that. And it ended up, he understood, like, we made the right decision. It was just caught him by surprise.
I was grateful, too, because I had written some sort of funny music for bits of this. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, some people might say is a little maybe old-fashioned or a little – it's not cool or hip or whatever.
Yeah, you leaned into it, and it's fun, and I just think we owned it. And it was –
yeah,
it was,
you know.
It helps sell the comedy of that.
And
that
I'm trying
scene
to do something
longer,
just a little bit different from what everybody else
– And it worked good for Phil's character there, too. You know, Phil, you know, plays one of the more overtly kind of, you know, comic appearances when he shows up.
One other thing I do, because with the schedule being what it is and having worked with you on Femme Fatales, what I like to do is I give you as much music as I can. I actually kind of wall-to-wall the show very often with the score that I present to you, and then have you guys at the mix. You can push and pull stuff, and there's often more music that I write than what you end up using, because with the schedule,
well,
I didn't want you to be calling me the day of the mix and going, oh, we need another 10 minutes of music for Act 4. You know, you've already got it. And then the stuff you don't use can be repurposed if it needs to be or slid around. So it's funny, when I watch the shows, I'm always like it's always fun for me to see what you ended up keeping and what you decided, you know, you didn't need for this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of film music. I mean, one of the reasons, obviously, I knew Joe's work so much is because, you know, very large film music collection. you know, which I love film music, you know, even before Star Wars, although that galvanized my interest a lot. But I mean, I used to, you know, I think it was really the Bond scores, you know, even before the John Barry's Bond scores that I was in. I used to steal the albums from my parents and listen to them. And then, of course, Star Wars was just, you know, blew me away. And I've been interested in film music ever since. But, you know, huge Jerry Goldsmith fan, John Barry, you know, just all these people. And so, you know, I don't have any kind of real musical education. So when I talk to Joe, you know, I talk about emotions, but I'll also talk about, oh, you know, can this be like, you know, John Barry and Body Heat, or maybe I want to lean into more Goldsmith, or this should be more lyrical, you know, like, and that's how I communicate my, you know, musically, because I can't tell you, oh, this is an Andante or whatever.
But see, that's better, actually, you know, because the one thing I don't want is you going like, oh, well, this is in France, so can we have French horns? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's better to talk about drama and character between us, and then I try, my job is to
translate,
interpret
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, very few directors and producers have any kind of real musical training and, you know, can, you know, speak that very specific language.
Yep. See, I like this too, because we shot a plate shot, so only the ship is CG. Everything else is real, which is why I think it looks so cool.
And that's a moment where I had the music was just a landing sort of thing, and you're like, "No, I want the theme there." And
triumphant. You know? I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of the show is like mixing. You know, is when we get to the mix stage here at Private Island, because. You know, we're finally in control of the show, and but you know, mixing sound effects and mixing score, and just it's really satisfying. Oh God, we did a total hero shot here too. We had a shot of them in slow motion, the Reservoir Dog shot. I think we used it in some of the promos, but it wasn't anything that really would have worked in context of the show. But yeah, so this is all kind of like some of the last stuff I wrote when we knew we weren't going to have Benita. And wrote this stuff for John. Yeah, so they weren't talking about Euphoria 7 with Benita.
Right.
Although, I mean, some people were shipping the two of them, you know, Jax and Benita.
Yeah, I saw some of that.
Although, you know, it would have been interesting in retrospect, you know, because then people were saying towards the end, it was like, you know, Pilar and Atria would have been interesting. But, you know, to me, it was like, it was really about the power of friendship. And it didn't necessarily need to be romantic at that point, because, you know, like, not everything's about, you know, not everybody has to be together romantically. Okay, and I kind of wanted to celebrate friendship a little bit. And, you know, the things you do for a good friend. But, you know, it's interesting had we gone in that direction.
It's really amazing to me where television has come in terms of VFX, in terms of production design, that you can have like the watch or the cufflink that can be a drone.
Oh,
you know,
it's crazy.
And the freedom it gives you during production, during shooting, to do things, and then to be able to put it in post. It gives you this whole ability to create a future that isn't anything like the present without, you know, and within the means of schedule and budget that television has versus, you know, a $300 million feature.
And we could have done even more with more time. At this point, it wasn't even, you know, it's just like, you know, there's other shots we could. I mean, even this, you know, some shots it's like sort of color timed. It's more brownish. And then other shots we didn't really, because that was a VFX timing thing. It wasn't something we did in color timing. So we could have adjusted it.
I love the lens Steve used there. Or, you know, whoever decided to use that lens.
Yeah, no, that's
great touch.
These caves were about 2 hours away, and I remember when I scouted them, I'm like, oh, this is going in. I think, you know, by then I had already had a script, but we changed the script to accommodate these caves. If I recall, I just love these. They're amazing, and I thought added so much production value to a show, which isn't particularly expensive. Whenever you can do. You know, stuff like this that gives you, like, you know, big scope and production value. And this is a combination of, you know, regular photography, and then we had the drone on the day as well, so we had some really cool high wides. And
yeah, real locations let us avoid doing, you know, CGI to make it
right.
You know, but with what Joe was saying, CGI does let us take a location or something which is not, you know, necessarily all that, you know, cinematic or amazing looking, you know, like the spaceport scene. You know, we can, you know, add so many things and make it look nice. This, you know, it just looks, you know, great locations make, you know, carry things a long ways.
I have to say, I haven't watched the pilot since July. I'm enjoying it. I think it's good.
When are we doing a VR episode? Like for my headset at home. So musical, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I was joking about it, but I'd like to do one eventually.
Yeah, why not?
You know,
that'd
maybe
be fun.
You know, maybe if
I still lament that we didn't have a chance on Femme Fatales to do a musical episode.
Well, we planned to do one called Curtains.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a great idea for it, too. It's just we didn't get picked up for third season because they reallocated all their money to Strike Back.
It's a nice thing when you're working on a series, which I knew was going to be 13 episodes. One benefit about scoring this without a pilot, but rather, you know, the full season being picked up, was that I could start building pieces now that I knew could pay off. But the other nice thing is to have a scene like this where I can do a score that's textural and tonal and have that balance, you know, throughout the score. Not every moment had to be a theme.
This was a nightmare getting down. There's no elevator to get down here. It was really not easy to get down to the cave. And then everything was so condensation. It was always dripping, which was awful for sound.
That's a great shot.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's the drone.
And how far away was this from our usual filming? Because you guys had to...
It's like 2 hours away.
Yeah, it's quite a trek.
And there were no... It's in the middle of nowhere, so there were no hotels, so we couldn't, like, stay out there. So both... We'd drive out, we'd shoot, we'd drive back, we'd drive out, we'd shoot, we'd drive back. It's so funny. A lot of these people... were added later. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you want to waste your VFX on, but a lot of these people were added because the cave seemed underpopulated. So our editor, Devin, you know, just felt like it doesn't feel like Close Encounters. Like he wanted to be Devil's Tower in Close Encounters. And so he digitally added a bunch of these people in the background, you know, going about their business.
Where did he get the footage?
We had shot them against green screen. More people against green screen. Because when we got the raw footage, we realized we didn't really have a lot of shots of people milling about and doing stuff. So, like, Devin, you know, really came up with this whole thing. And there's the portal.
So you can hear, like, if you're listening to the score, you can hear the vocal quality there come in from the portal. The singer who ends up being she ends up being sort of the voice of the Protectors on the soundtrack, is a singer I met in London. And so I would write something here, and then I'd send it to my friend Ian in London, who's a composer as well, and she lives upstairs from him. So he'd run up there and record it, send it back to me, and then I'd cut it into the show.
That's how the Beatles did it.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, but that's the thing with, again, like production on the music side, like you've got with Chris... doing the VFX, you know, I don't think he's in L.A., right?
No, he's in Atlanta.
Right. So similarly, like, we could use musicians all over the world because of the internet.
Yeah, and I was wondering how, you
and
know,
I have to say,
where that came from.
This whole scene, this is really, again, a testament to Chris. Because it was in the script, you know, like, oh, they go to a world that's completely different than ours. You know, it's like almost another dimension, this whole thing. And, you know. And we're looking for places to film it and all this stuff. And really, no one had a clue. Like what? And it was Chris who said, you know, you remember that Darren Aronofsky film, The Fountain? I was like, yeah. He's like, you know, it was something like that. And he said, like, if you hang up the... So literally, this is them in front of Christmas lights.
Right.
It's them on a green screen stage in front of a bunch of Christmas lights. And the rest is all digital environment. And... It's really cool. And I remember, you know, a couple of things, you know, that big wide shot I insisted on adding because I felt it was like, I wanted a sense of like awe and it was, but he really just had such a great vision for it, did such a great job. This is another scene, you watch the dailies on it, it's just embarrassing because of course it's men in suits with these, you know, pool cleaners or whatever they're holding.
Man in suit.
Man in suit, yeah. And
this was fun for me to do a bit of a pastiche on the whole, you know, Star Wars sort of.
Well, I have two things to say about that.
Gunfight.
First of all, I love that Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid thing when he saves him and they give him a look like, thank you, kind of like, but won't say it. It's kind of like, to me, that was where I realized what their relationship was. And I love it. But in terms of the music, it kills me because when it was compressed and aired on like DirecTV, we mixed it really loud.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you watched it on TV, you could barely hear. I'm like, where's that music? Aww. The whole scene only works because of the music. And it was like, and it was like you could barely hear it. I walked out of the living room. I remember my wife's like, "Where are you going?" And it's like, "I can't watch it like this."
Yeah, I got it. I got a call from you, I think.
Yeah.
At whatever o'clock at night, it's like, "What's going on with the sound?" It's like, "What are you talking about?"
Now, the pilot, I was still in L.A., so I was able to do it here and, you know, preview stuff for you. By the time we got to the episode 4, I think, I was in London and Vienna. And so that's another
Vienna
thing
about for you.
Well, it had the production of the show was a truly international because I was writing a lot of the music that I was writing. I was doing it in a hotel room in Vienna, you know, and then uploading. And then Penka and I were collaborating.
Right,
and so it was, you know, that's a great thing, again, about production and schedule. You know, technology's at a point now where I can write the score anywhere.
See, I like these spaceships. I think they're cool. You know, it feels military, and it's like, you know, I just like when there were days where I'm like, we're filming on a spaceship, you know, it's like spaceship corridors, and it's like a battleship, and it's like, I forget which, oh, this is the Tereshkova, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had names for all those, you know,
that is this the one where the med center, is the door outside the med center that has the sort of rounded holes in the wall?
Yeah,
I like those. They remind me of something, but I just can't remember
this is the med center.
What?
But I love what Max did here with the lighting, too. I mean, you know. Max is one of those secret weapons. He's actually back in Berlin right now. He couldn't be with us. But so, you know, throughout, he was a lifesaver and just gave this such a beautiful look.
It's funny, too, for me to see this because I got to be honest, I don't think I've seen half the finished shots.
Oh, right.
Ever.
Yeah.
You know, because I work on the show. I spend a lot of time with it and I deliver it, but it's always the green screen and placeholders.
And then you never want to watch it again.
Well, it's not that I never want to. It's, you know, the next episode came along.
Yeah,
I had to do that, you know.
Yeah, here you go. Here's
those round things in the wall. They remind me of another universe.
Oh, you mean the Star Wars look?
I didn't say that. No.
What? Yeah.
And Billy Joel here.
It's I know. Everybody calls that so funny. I know. We were joking. Oh my God, it's Billy Joel.
When will you realize?
He turned his hand and said, "Only the good die young."
Yeah. I didn't start the fire.
Yeah, I'd like him to do Rock and Roll Color Wars, do the next three verses, do 2199, then the Minbari, the Zatarian War.
Did you say Minbar?
I said Minbar.
Wow,
that's like
nice.
Babylon 5, right?
Wow.
Wow, that's deep cut.
We don't hear that from you very often.
No, I like Babylon 5.
I worked on Babylon 5.
Did you?
Yeah, it was my first job in L.A. It's dialogue editing. Back in the day.
No, I like Babylon 5.
There's the voice, by the way. That's Paul's.
The protector coral thing. And, I mean, this is a cool room. This is a multi-purpose room. We use this for a lot of things, you know. In 103, it was like Jaroski's personal quarters.
Right.
Later on, it was a Hypatia syndicate ship. This is the same room we just shot in, believe it or not.
Turn the other way.
Yeah.
And this was fun because I had these really cool flute samples that were just not played like a traditional melody, but sort of underblown and overblown and creating all these cool textures.
And super titles. Because I come from publishing, fonts are very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was giving out a book on fonts to all these people. I'm like, they give me these awful fonts like Helvetica and stuff for shit. And I'm being like, no, we have to pick the right font. I mean, one of the things that actually I teared up during Rogue One was they were using the actual same font as Star Wars. It was like, okay, they get it.
That bugs me actually on some of the DVDs and Blu-rays that have come out or digital versions where it's a machine-generated font rather player-generated.
Me too. Well,
same with
Annie
Hall,
I think. Annie Hall, yep. And on Star Wars, if you watch it on Disney Plus, because everybody's watching McClunky now, it's the computer-generated. It's not the actual font. It makes me crazy. I remember the first time I got crazy about that was in Tomorrow Never Dies with that awful super title, Terrorist Arms Bazaar.
Right.
But it wasn't even the font, the optical font. It was like the computer
player-generated so that it could be in any
language. Closed caption files.
Right. So it was funny with that scene with the father with Raylan's dad, Penka, when we had a spotting session, because we did one and two in the same session, so she was here even though she wasn't. Anyway, she was like, hey, I recognize some of those words, you know, because.
No, it's Bulgarian.
Yeah.
Bastardized Bulgarian.
Yeah.
McClunky. We got to get that in there. There was a scene cut before this, which I wish we'd left. It was totally cut for time, where Jax goes to Vikash about what happened to get his advice, and he's surprisingly helpful.
Joe Kramer.
Joe Kramer. Wow, that's the episode. I'm introducing a bounty hunter named McClunky next episode.
Okay.
No, I'm not. But it's I'm going to work McClunky in somehow.
Maybe for the musical.
Right.
McClunky.
Aaron
Ratner. Yeah. So great experience. It was amazing. We got through that first episode, but we got to do 12 more that, you know, we just kept building on what we did. And I'm really proud of it. And thank you all for listening. And we'll see you next week on Unboxing Pandora.
Live long and perspire.
That's how you're going to go out with a bad pun like that? Come on, say something profound. Say something. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Thank you, Aaron. Great having you, Joe. Thanks for finally. Thanks. We finally got you to sit in. I'm so happy to have you here, and you're such a big part of the success of this show. So
thanks,
I'm glad you joined us. So we're going to close the box on Pandora now, but we'll see you for another episode real soon.